All right. So we're continuing through the book of Revelation, and we're dealing with these sort of fascinating images in the middle of the book, probably the images that create as much confusion as anything. And I guess what I'm trying to do is present it from a biblical perspective. And as I mentioned before, we're looking at it from what's called a preterist view. We've talked about the fact there's four views on the book of Revelation, broadly speaking. So there's the preterist view, which preterist means in the past. So that's the view that the things that John prophesied were in the future from John's perspective, but they're in the past from ours and centered around the destruction of the city of Jerusalem in AD 70. The historicist view looks at the book of Revelation as the future from John's perspective, and the past from our perspective, in a sense that it covers the history of the church throughout the ages. And so a lot of what the historicists would be looking at in terms of where we're up to in the book of Revelation would be to do with the Reformation and the conflict with the Catholic Church and so on. Next view is the futurist view, which sort of says that the book of Revelation is future for John and it's future for us as well, that none of the things, or most of what is prophesied there hasn't occurred yet and we're still waiting for those things to happen. And then the fourth view is the the idealist view, which kind of says that the prophecies in the book of Revelation are not really about specific events in at a particular time, but they kind of just reveal truths about the church and its sort of ongoing issues throughout time. So all of the book is relevant at all of the time. As I said, I've sort of come to the view that the preterist perspective is probably, for me, the most consistent one, because it focuses around Christ, and the book is a revelation of Christ, and there's other issues that we've been touching on along the way that speak to that for me. So that's just my perspective, but of course we're staying loose in the saddle, aren't we? And I'm fine if you disagree with me. That's okay. It's important that the church continues the conversation. And each of those views has seen favour at different times. And probably at this time there is a resurgence of the preterist and the historicist perspectives. But certainly the idealist perspective is the one that has the most sway within the broader church community at this stage. I've been through all that before. So let's go to Revelation chapter 12. And we've just been dealing with the two witnesses and what they're about in terms of the fact that that in order to carry out a judgment, that it's required by law that two witnesses brought forward. And so the two witnesses represent the law and the prophets. They represent the church, they represent Jesus, Moses and Elijah, and so on. But basically the indictment is that Israel has rejected the Messiah, and as a result the city of Jerusalem and its system of worship is to be destroyed in order that there's no confusion with the new worship that's established in heaven under Christ. So Revelation chapter 12 and verse 1 says, "And a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was pregnant and was crying out in birth pains and the agony of giving birth." Now, the woman, it's generally held is symbolic of the covenant community, that is the Old Testament church, the faithful Israel, is another way of putting that. One commentator, David Chilton, writes, "She is Eve, the mother of all living, whose seed will crush the dragon's head. She's also Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, Jochebed, Hannah, and the other women of the covenant who gave birth to deliverers, forerunners of the seed, She is the Virgin Mary, through whom the promise to the fathers met their fulfillment. But this great cosmic figure cannot simply be identified with any one of these women. Rather, each of them individually embodied and portrayed before the world a different facet of the woman's meaning, imaging the labours of the church to give birth to the Messiah. We see reflections of this image in other parts of the Old Testament. So, for example, in Song of Songs, where Solomon is sort of writing or waxing lyrical with his bride, which is sort of recognised as a book about Christ and the church. It says in Song of Songs, chapter 6 and verse 4, "You are beautiful as Tisra, my love, lovely as Jerusalem, awesome as an army with banners." And then in verse 10 it says, "Who is this who looks down like the dawn, beautiful as the moon, bright as the sun, awesome as an army with banners?" We also see that the image is reminiscent of Joseph's vision, where he had a vision of his family bowing down to him, and Israel was represented as the sun and the moon and the stars. And so here we have this image with the sun and the moon and the stars involved with the woman. And so there's a sense in which the woman is the true Israel. In Isaiah chapter 7 and verse 10, we've got Isaiah coming to Ahaz, who was a wicked king. And again, the Lord spoke to Ahaz, "Ask a sign of the Lord your God. Let it be deep as Sheol or as high as heaven." But Ahaz said, "I will not ask. I will not put the Lord to the test." And he said, "Hear then, O house of David, is it too little for you to weary men that you weary my God also? Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. He shall eat curds and honey when he knows how to refuse, and honey when he knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the boy knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land whose two kings you dread will be deserted. The Lord will bring upon you and upon your people and upon your father's house such days as have not come since the day that Ephraim departed from Judah, the king of Assyria." Really interesting passage, because the inference is that Ahaz has asked, you tell me where you want the sign and I'll put it there. Ahaz refuses, so God says, "Well, I'm going to give you the sign of the woman, the virgin with child, and when he comes, it's going to mean the destruction of your house, of apostate Israel." And the sign, as we see in Revelation 12, is in the skies or in the heavens. So this great sign was given as a promise of the birth of Christ, the seed that would defeat Satan, which was promised through Eve right back in Genesis, and the defeat of Satan and the destruction of apostate Israel. And the fact that the sign appeared in heaven is thought by some commentators to refer to the zodiac. Now, I would just say that often when we talk about the zodiac, it's in relation to astrology, which we know is a wicked thing, because we're not to go to the stars for direction. That's, there's many places in Scripture where where God rebukes those who have bowed down to the starry hosts and sought them for direction. The stars are not there to give us direction, but the stars are there to testify to the glory of God and to tell us the times and the seasons. There's a really interesting area of study that looks at the astrological signs, or rather the zodiac signs. And the zodiac is special because it's the series of stars that follow the ecliptic. And the ecliptic is the path that the sun follows in the sky because of the rotation of the earth. And so there's 12 signs in the zodiac. There are commentators who have put together quite a detailed thesis on how the signs of the zodiac actually tell the gospel. And so we see the gospel laid out in the stars. If you're sort of into those sorts of things, you can get into that. But Professor Ernest Martin, he's done a fair bit of work on this, and he notes that the constellation Virgo is a constellation that is pictured as a woman with 12 stars around her head. And he suggests that this was the great sign during the seventh month. So the constellation Virgo is actually the greatest constellation during the seventh month of the year, which is about this time of year. And the reason that happens is because it's sort of comes into contact with the sun, if that makes sense. So you know how the stars are sort of fixed in position, but the sun's moving, the earth's moving, and so on. But from our perspective, the stars kind of move around the sky every 12 months. And of course, the day and night sort of means that there are times when the sun is in front of certain constellations. Now, we can't see them because it's daytime. You can't see the stars in the day. But that's their position, and that's why they're given preeminence, because of their interaction with the sun. And so Ernest Martin says, well, Virgo is in this position in the seventh month, and it's interesting the way that John describes it, because we've got the woman clothed with the sun, which Ernest Martin says means that Virgo is aligned with the sun, and she has the moon under her feet. Now, he's done a fair bit of work looking into the time of Christ's birth and so on, and he came to the decision that the date was around in the 3rd century AD. And if we align the sort of symbols here, it means that the birth of Christ probably happened somewhere between late August and early October. And in the year 3 AD, to have the sun in the belly of Virgo, which means that she was clothed with the sun, and the moon in that position under her feet, he was able to locate it down to about a one-hour period in 3rd century AD. It sort of was between about 6:15 and 7:45 on the 11th of September in 3 AD. Now, that's all conjecture, okay? We're not going to run off and try and change the date of Christmas and all that sort of thing. It's really, in one sense, it doesn't matter when Jesus was born. The fact that he was born is the critical thing. But in terms of the message that John is communicating here, he's sort of, the fact that it was a great sign in the sky, and the fact that the Magi came from the east having recognized the signs in the sky to realize that the Messiah was born at that time in Bethlehem, Martin suggests that this is the sign that the Magi were actually following at the time. Maybe they were, maybe they weren't. But September the 11th in 3 AD was actually the first day of Tishri, which we talked about last time. And Tishri is the day of trumpets. And on the day of Tishri was when the seventh trumpet of the festivals was sounded. And in Revelation, we have this image of there being seven trumpets. And we're now at the point where the seventh trumpet has been sounded. And this sort of image appears in the sky. In a sense, acknowledging the fact that the Messiah has been born in 3 AD. And we're looking at the victory of the Messiah as the context of everything that's going on. Now, you can feel free to forget everything I just said. That's fine. Some of you might find it interesting. Some are going, oh, I don't know what he's talking about. But there's, you know, if you're interested in sort of more information, you can find it. But that's a fascinating conjecture, but I wouldn't be building doctrine around it necessarily. But it is interesting that this sign correlates with the month of Tishri, the first of Tishri, the day of trumpets in 3 AD, because we talked a little bit about that in chapter 11 as an evidence of judgment, but also of God's grace and his mercy. Let's go to verse 3. We'll move away from that, although not entirely. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his heads 7 diadems, that's crowns. His tail swept a third of the stars of heaven and cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she bore her child, he might devour it. Of course, we know that the great red dragon is Satan, and he symbolizes the enemies of the church. And he's represented here as a composite of the beast that Daniel saw, which represented the kingdoms of the earth. We also see that these are the powers who resisted the people of God and whose heads were crushed by God's salvation again and again in anticipation of the seed who would come and defeat Satan entirely. And so we've got a lot of pictures going on here, a lot of images. And as I said, for first century Christians who understood the sort of background of the Old Testament and were sort of raised in that worldview, this would have been sparking sort of images and pictures all over the place. Because Satan had tried time and time again to destroy the promised seed of the woman, but was unable to. So if we trace it back, Satan inspired, Cain tried to kill Abel. That was a satanic act, in a sense. And really, trying to kill off the seed that was promised that would crush the head of the serpent. And we can follow that through time and time again. Wherever someone is sort of upheld as being a representation of Christ, then there's an attempt to take their life, because we see this pattern sort of played out throughout history. So even Abraham giving up his wife Sarah on two occasions, saying that she was his sister, was kind of Satan tried to take out the seed. But again, God stepped in on both occasions and saved her and returned her to Abraham. Pharaoh tried to kill the sons of the Israelites in another attempt to take out the seed. Following through, there's lots of examples, I'm just picking a few. David being chased by Saul and Saul trying to kill him under his sort of demonic possession. Then David's son Absalom tried to kill him as well. We move through. Herod tried to kill all of the children in Bethlehem when Jesus was born, and so on. So we've constantly got this image of the woman, the church, in the Old Testament, bringing forth the deliverer, the seed, and the dragon, the sort of world powers at that time, trying to devour the seed being born and given birth to bring deliverance on the earth. We doing okay? The other interesting thing is that in terms of the zodiac, the constellation that follows Virgo is Scorpius. And Scorpius is a scorpion, and his pincers reach out towards Virgo, the woman, and his tail encompasses a third of the zodiac. So that's just an interesting sort of image. So when we're talking about these great signs in the sky, we're possibly talking about astronomical sort of pictures that are being played out in the heavens as people are observing them. All right, let's keep going. Verse 5. And she gave birth to a male child who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron, but her child was caught up to God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness where she has a place prepared by God in which she is to be nourished for 1,260 days. So, of course, the Messiah, Jesus, was born successfully and ascended to the right hand of the Father. Now, understanding that this is an apocalyptic image, it's sort of a picture to tell a story. So it kind of shortcuts from Jesus' birth to his ascension. It doesn't tell the rest of the story, but that's not necessary because really playing on Psalm 2, which says in verse 7, I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, you are my son, today I have begotten you. Ask of me and I will give the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. So here we have the birth of a son who's given the nations. He's ascended to a place of victory, and then it's his place to enact judgment. So while Mary did flee to Egypt, this time the flight into the wilderness kind of speaks of the flight of the Judean Christians from the destruction of Jerusalem, where the Lord sheltered them for 1,260 days, or as we've said, that's 42 months, which is 3.5 years, which is time times and half a time. It's this period of tribulation or a broken seven where God's judgment is poured out. I feel like I'm starting to talk in code. Is that happening for you? Because I'm making reference to stuff that we've already covered, and if you haven't been here for the other stuff that we've covered, I'm probably talking gibberish. You know how I found out recently, I've started a new job and everyone talks in acronyms, and it's taken me ages to work out what they're talking about, because you've got to work out what all these letters mean. So sorry if it's that way for you, but I'm just trying to get through this without getting too bogged down. Because the context is that God would, Jesus said, when you see the city surrounded by the Gentiles, then flee the city. And so the Christians were called to leave the city because destruction was coming when the city was surrounded by Gentiles. So Jesus prophesied that the church was to leave Jerusalem. There were also other prophets that prophesied to the church. Eusebius, who was a church historian in the 4th century, wrote about this time. He said, "But the people of the church in Jerusalem had been commanded by a revelation vouchsafed to approved men there before the war to leave the city and to dwell in a certain town of Perea called Pella. And when those that believed in Christ had come thither from Jerusalem, then, as if the royal city of the Jews and the whole land of Judea were entirely destitute of holy men, the judgment of God at length overtook those who had committed such outrages against Christ and his apostles, and totally destroyed that generation of impious men." So the church wasn't abandoned by God during the tribulation, but rather it is protected and nourished by him because the Messiah has come, and he has won the victory, and he's ascended to the right hand of the Father. Verse 7 says, "Now war arose in heaven, Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon. And the dragon and his angels fought back, but he was defeated, and there was no longer any place for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent, who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him." Now, obviously that speaks about, prophetically, of the time when Satan was removed from heaven, but that's John has shifted the context here. So we ought not to think of this portion of the vision as Satan and his angels taking on heaven in vengeance for the fact that the Messiah has been born and he's ascended to heaven, that he's missed the catch, as it were. But rather, what we see here is that Christ is the aggressor as he sends Michael and his angels to make war against Satan in response to the victory that he's purchased on the cross, so that the dragon is thrown down with his angels in a defeated state, just as it was in the beginning. So John's taking a lot of pictures here from the Old Testament, and he's kind of fashioning a fresh understanding of the gospel for us. So he's saying that, that as it were, the woman, the true Israel, has given birth to the Messiah, the seed that is going to crush the Satan's head, that, you know, that Eve was going to deliver. He's been born and he's been given birth through the nation of Israel. And as a result of that, he's ascended into victory at the Father's right hand. He's won the victory on the cross, and he's now seated with the Father in that place of victory. And as a result of his victory, Satan has been cast down. And it's not like heaven is defending itself against Satan. Heaven has been the aggressor, the ones who's been on the front foot and gone and thrown Satan down. And so verse 10 says, "And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they love not their lives even unto death. Therefore rejoice, O heaven, and you who dwell in them. But woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in great wrath, because he knows that his time is short." So the result of the victory of Christ through his incarnation, life, death, burial, resurrection, and ascension is that Christ is victorious over all, and with him, his church. It's really interesting the way that John puts this, because salvation and power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come as a result of Satan being thrown down. But it also goes on to say that they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and the word of their testimony. So obviously this speaks of the martyrs in the church and those that are in the church being involved in the defeat of Satan. And it's this sort of participatory sort of thing that really is quite fascinating. That Satan was defeated by Christ and was conquered by the faithful martyrs through the blood of Christ and their testimony. So the heavens rejoice in the victory of Christ, but they pronounce woe to the land and the nations, because the wrath of the devil is about to be poured out, as he knows his time is short. And his primary target is going to be Jerusalem, because he's after the woman. And so in this, the third woe has been pronounced. Remember, there were three woes right back when the seventh trumpet sounded, and this is the third woe. David Chilton writes, "The victory over the dragon, according to St. John, does not take place by means of a cataclysmic event at the end of history, but by means of the cataclysmic event in the middle of history, the sacrifice of the Lamb. The cosmic victory over the dragon takes place through the gospel and the gospel alone. The gospel in its objective aspect, the work of Christ, and the gospel in its subjective aspect, the proclamation of the word of Christ." So we move to verse 13. It says, "And when the dragon saw that he had been thrown down to the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. But the woman was given the two wings of the great eagle, so that she might fly from the serpent into the wilderness, to the place where she is to be nourished for a time and times and half a time. The serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman to sweep her away with a flood. But the earth came to the help of the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed the river that the dragon had poured from his mouth. So although the dragon pursued the woman, the church, she was rescued by God and taken with the wings of the great eagle to fly to the wilderness. Now this creates some other pictures for those that understand the context from the Old Testament. Speaking of the deliverance of the Israelites from the Egyptians, in Deuteronomy 32 and verse 10 it says, "He found him in a desert land, and in the howling waste of the wilderness. He encircled him and cared for him. He kept him as the apple of his eye, like an eagle that stirs up its nest, that flutters over its young, spreading out its wings, catching them and bearing them on its pinions." And so we see that there's a deliverance image happening here, that God is going to deliver his church through the destruction that's about to come on. Now, it says the earth in a lot of translations, but we've talked about this before, that word earth can be translated as land, as opposed to the sea, which in a prophetic image is talking about the land of Israel, as opposed to the nations of the world. So we have this, what some commentators call creation language, where the Spirit of God is brooding over the wasteland, just like the Spirit hovered over the waters of the desolate waters at the beginning. And in doing so, he's nourishing his new creation, the church, for time, times, and half a time. In other words, nourishing him through the destruction that's going to come on Jerusalem. So Satan seeks to attack the woman by pouring water out to sweep her away, just as Pharaoh tried to wash the Israelite sons away in the Nile River. But in this instance, the land opened its mouth to swallow the river. And so the picture that John's trying to build here is that going after the woman, true Jerusalem, God has rescued the woman by taking the church out of the city of Jerusalem. And so the torrent that's poured forth from Satan's mouth, that is the violent attack that comes from the nations against Israel, is going to be poured out on the land, but not upon the church, which is the true Jerusalem or the true Israel. And so it's the city of Jerusalem that swallows up, as it were, this torrent that is poured out by Satan. And Chilton says, by the time Rome attacks, the church has left Jerusalem. The land of Israel swallows the river by absorbing the blow in her place. The destruction of Jerusalem left the true city and temple unharmed, for they were safe with the woman under the shadow of the Almighty. Verse 17 says, then the dragon became furious with the woman and went off to make war on the rest of her offspring, on those who keep the commands of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. And he stood on the sand of the sea. So unable to destroy the church by destroying Jerusalem, Satan stands on the shore of the sea, that is the edge of the Gentile nations, then heads off to make war with the Gentile Christians. Again, trying to destroy the woman. But the context is that Satan is fighting a losing battle, that he's already been overcome by Christ and by Michael and the angels, as well as the martyrs. And he's continuing to fight, but his cause is lost because the saints also have won the victory over him by the blood of the Lamb and the word of their testimony, and they don't love their lives even unto death. As Chilton says, ever since Christ's ascension, world history has been a mopping up operation. The church militant, so long as she is the church obedient, will be the church triumphant. So we've come to a point now where the seven trumpets have sounded. We've had these images going on, and there's another chapter of images that are, you know, yet to come. But we're moving towards the pouring out of the bowls of wrath on the city of Jerusalem. But just as happened previously between the opening of the seven seals and the seven trumpets, we've got this image of the big picture in heaven to give us context to what's happening. And so the Holy Spirit through John is trying to communicate that even though there's destruction coming for Jerusalem, the church is actually victorious. Even though it looks like Satan's going to, you know, is winning, he's actually losing. That there is, the defeat has already occurred, and he's been defeated by Christ. He's been defeated by the heavenly hosts, and he has been defeated by the church. And even though he stands on the shore of the sea, seeking how he can attack the Gentile church, he is operating from a position of defeat. And so it is today, that the church is victorious on the earth. And that's the message of the book of Revelation, that God hasn't left us on this earth to try and somehow work it out and hang on long enough until Jesus comes back to save us. He's already saved us, and he's already given us the victory, and we are going out upon the earth to establish the victory of Christ wherever we find wherever our feet take us. And, you know, the picture there is really that we're not defeated, that the church is expanding on the earth. This is the image that Daniel was given, where the stone that was uncut by human hands smashed the feet of the statue that represented the empires of the world. And once it smashed the statue, it began to grow into a mountain that covered the whole earth. That's the picture of the church. This is what Christ has established through his ascension. Which is the picture that we saw in chapter 11, that the heavens were open and the Ark of the Covenant was there in the heavenlies, and everyone was worshipping Jesus, and that victory flows down onto the earth today, and it's our job to continue to carry that out and to put Satan down wherever we happen to find him. And his fight is not a fight that he's going to win. In a sense, his fight is a fight of frustration because he is losing, and we have the victory.